I'd like to welcome Jerry Dennis and Glenn Wolf to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome.
Thank you, Aaron.
Jerry's had a 30-year career. You're into, what, 12 books now and lots of articles, lots of stories, a national reputation, but so much of your work is centered in northern Michigan.
It's true. I didn't even realize that till recently.
Glenn, you're a well-known artist in the Traverse City area. You grew up here, then you were attracted by bright lights in big cities, established yourself and your career in New York, and then came back in 1987. Recently, in addition to all your artwork, you've been doing collaborations with a number of writers.
I feel really lucky, you know, at 60 years old to be collaborating with the amazing people that I am working with right now.
And the work is just terrific. And today we're going to be talking about It's Raining Frogs and Fishes, Four Seasons of Natural Phenomena and Oddities of the Sky. And we're talking about a rebirth almost, aren't we? This book came out 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Well, it was our first collaboration. And the moment really the light bulb went off is one that Glenn and I both look back on fondly, because it was actually at the very first meeting we ever had. We were in high school together. We were a year apart in high school, but didn't know each other. And then I started hearing about this guy in New York who's illustrating for many of the magazines that I was starting to write for in the late 1980s. And I'm saying, that's Glenn Wolf. I remember him from school, right? And my wife knew him as the art star at Traverse City Senior High School.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking around, and he seemed to be in every magazine I wanted to write for. So we had a mutual friend who, shortly after Glenn moved back to Traverse City, said, you guys have to meet, and put us together. And I'm on the phone with him. I said, well, let's have lunch and meet. And we sat down to lunch. And by the end of that lunch at Stacy's restaurant downtown, the old Stacy's, we had this idea for a whole series of books about wonders of nature. And the first one would be about wonders of the sky.
So your intended audience of this book, It's Raining Frogs and Fishes.
We wanted to answer the questions that our kids were asking us that we couldn't answer. And so the intended audience right from the beginning was the parents and grandparents of young children who are asking those great questions, like why is the sky blue and what causes where do meteors come from and what causes hail and is it true that no two snowflakes are alike and stuff. You know, a lot of basic mm-hmm. science stuff that somehow most of the people we talked to didn't really know the answers to.
And when I read the book, it hit me immediately that these were all the questions my grandsons were asking.
We hear that constantly to this day.
So could you talk about the content of the book? It's divided in four sections, and those mm-hmm. four sections are broken out.
As the seasons, we broke it down because we saw that many of the things that we wanted to write about, we just followed our own interests. We said, what are we interested in? Basically, everything in nature that takes place above the ground was fascinating to us. How insects fly and how their wings evolved and how feathers work in a bird and why some birds migrate and some don't. And we saw that all those subjects broke down really naturally into seasons mm-hmm. that we found that sky watching was best in the winter and spring in the fall because the sky is clearer and you can get out and really see those stars. Spring, of course, migration season and thunderstorm, the first thunderstorms of the year, etc. And so we just easily broke it down that way. And basically what we would do is I would start to rough out a chapter and I would fax it in those days to Glenn, and he would start roughing out a drawing in pencil, and he'd fax it back, and we'd have this interchange that was just nothing but a blast, the whole process.
So you get the text, and then how would you work at it?
I'd start collecting reference or, you know, looking up my own visual reference,
mm-hmm.
or in some cases, you know, I know when we were doing the Northern Lights chapter, there was an amazing display that night that we were working on, and we were both standing in our yards, talking about the color show that was going on over our heads. So it was a mixture of, photographs, book reference, and as much real life stuff as I could find.
Because the text and the drawings go together so well and really amplify one another.
Oh, thanks.
It fell together so naturally. We knew that this was the right way to do it, because very many times, countless times, we would have the same idea separately, and then when we get together to talk, we'd realize, hey, we're right on the same page time after time after time. So the Aurora example was a really good one. We both had a feel for the Aurora and how great that on the very week we were working on that chapter, we saw the best display of our lives. I remember waking the kids up and wrapping them in blankets and taking them out in the yard to see that, and it was an amazing display.
One of the interesting chapters or bits of a chapter is the actual title of your book. It's Raining Frogs and Fishes. Could you read part of that for us?
Sure. I'll explain it a little bit. As we were working on it, we had an opportunity to write and illustrate a regular column for the magazine Wildlife Conservation, mm-hmm. which is published at the Bronx Zoo. They were old clients of Glenn's from when he lived in New York, and they were really open to the idea of a column about wonders of wildlife. And when we were talking to the editor about the columns one day, we threw this idea out that we had been reading about these rains of living things from the sky that go back to antiquity. I had been finding references to them in Pliny from the first century AD and before that from Aristotle and many other ancient writers. And so I started researching the idea, and so that chapter began as a column in the magazine. So I'll read just a portion of it. When it comes to peculiar weather, we lead sheltered lives. Most of us have seen nothing more remarkable fall from the sky than snowflakes and hailstones. Naturally, we've learned to expect a fair amount of order and predictability from precipitation. But in 1921, an ichthyologist at the American Museum of Natural History challenged all notions of security by publishing a paper in the journal Natural History, treating seriously an aspect of weather that had seldom been treated seriously before. The ichthyologist, E.W. Gudger, titled his paper Rains of Fishes. Gudger had run across a newspaper story describing small fish found scattered on New York City streets after a heavy shower in the summer of 1824. The description intrigued him. Investigating further, he uncovered a report by a woman in Indiana who claimed to have found a live minnow swimming in rainwater in a hollow in her woodpile's chopping block. Eventually, Gudger collected dozens of similar accounts, ranging back hundreds of years, of people claiming to have witnessed fish descending from the sky during rainstorms. Among those incidents he collected were a boisterous rain of herring in Scotland in 1821, with the fish so abundant that tenants of the land were compelled to turn the booty over to their landlord. The depositions of 10 residents of Jellapur, India, who observed a fall of fish one noon in February 1830 and collected from the ground and from the roofs of houses large numbers of fish weighing up to 6 pounds. And the 1861 report of Sir J. Emerson Tennant, author of Sketches of the Natural History of Ceylon, who witnessed a violent rain shower on the road ahead of him and found, he wrote, a multitude of small silvery fish, 1.5 to 2 inches in length, leaping on the gravel of the high road. Gudger was the first scientist to really take this phenomenon seriously. And before that, everybody had assumed that it was in the same category as teleportation and phantom lights and spontaneous combustion of humans. So a lot of his colleagues in the biological sciences really looked down their noses at his research at first. Gudger had listed four possible explanations for this phenomenon of falling fishes and frogs. First, that witnesses had observed certain species known to migrate overland, such as mudskippers and the walking catfish of Asia. Second, that overflowage from ponds, streams, and gutters had left fish stranded on land. Third, that estivating fish, awakened by heavy rains, had burrowed to the surface. And fourth, and the one that he advocated, was that fish and frogs and other living things had been lifted from nearby oceans or lakes by water spouts or tornadoes, carried overland, and dumped to the ground. Well, this man, Charles Fort, who was a renegade scientist, had come up with a fifth theory. He had spent most of his life searching out references to unusual natural phenomena such as rains of animals. In his Book of the Damned, Fort listed references to falls of a dozen species of fish and reptiles, as well as such varied stuff as fungi, stones, including some inscribed with arcane messages, hatchets, masks, and mysterious masses of protoplasm. To explain such falls, Fort argued for the existence of a Super Sargasso Sea suspended a few miles above the Earth, just above the reach of gravity, he wrote, in which interstellar flotsam collected and was occasionally displaced. Fort attracted a small but devoted following, and the International Fortean Organization remains active today. But for obvious reasons, his theories were never accepted by mainstream scientists. So you could see what Gudger was up against.
One of the interesting things about each one of these categories is you provide sort of a history from the earliest explanations through, and you go to Greek and Latin or before, through the medieval period with people trying to come up with explanations of different phenomena. And then science finally sort of disambiguating the whole thing. And I think that's so useful for young readers because it gives them a way of thinking about the world and how we learn things.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And it was a real big motivation for us. And it was part of the great fun of researching and producing the book was that we knew right from the beginning that we wanted to explore why humans, for all known history, have been so fascinated and in awe of the sky and so frightened of the sky. Many of our superstitions center around these things. In the chapter on comets, we were astonished at how similar the accounts were through all of history of people considering comets as harbingers of bad tidings.
Yes.
And to the point where people panicked. They ran to the streets screaming sometimes. They were so freaked out by this anomaly. Because the skies, they thought, we have always thought, are the one thing in life that never changes. Mm-hmm. At least you can always count on looking up and seeing the stars. But what happens when there's a new star and it's moving and in a way that we're not accustomed to? Yeah. The planets were a big mystery for hundreds, probably thousands of years. Why are they moving? What makes them change? Why are they different than the rest of the stars, which seem to be fixed in place? So that was a big part of our delight, was to explore those areas. And kids grab it. They understand why the mystery and why there's so much to be awestruck about.
And you work through lightning. You work through rainbows. You work through, good question today, of how do chickadees stay warm when it's 11 below or whatever.
Yeah, and then again, you know, I think it was my youngest son Nick who said, "Dad, how come the birds are shivering?" And I had never noticed that they're on the bird feeder and they're shivering. And I did the research and discovered they shiver to raise their body temperature the same as we do. It makes perfect sense. And they puff up their feathers in a tactic called piloerection to increase the amount of air trapped under the feathers for better insulation.
So, Glenn, it must have been a challenge for you along the way to match the text with the drawings.
Well, it, only in that the text is so good, it really doesn't need drawings. Mm-hmm.
And the text is really good, but the drawings are terrific.
Well, thanks. But it was the same kind of a thing. I just visually the folklore and mythology of, you know, old illuminated manuscripts and star charts, I always get inspiration from that stuff. So to let that influence in parts of the drawing, and then, you know, maybe show an archaic star chart, you know, a comet, a star with horrid hair, and then like do a dissection of it showing, you know, that it's partly made of ice or whatever, to blend those two, you know, the myth and the science. And it was really fun.
It must have been fascinating to see how artists from earlier times tried to capture that phenomena.
Yeah, I've always loved that.
So this book has also an interesting publishing history.
It has a checkered past.
Well, it was published by HarperCollins, one of the big mm-hmm. publishers in New York, and
it was a bestseller.
It was a national bestseller, and we were delighted. And it was translated into a bunch of languages, and you know, just couldn't have been happier. But about 5 years ago, I guess, they, without explanation, just let it go out of print and just said they weren't going to reprint it, even though it was still being used in classes. It was still selling, as far as we knew. And so we just figured, well, that's their business. So we got the rights back to it.
So let's get this. It was published in 1992.
Yeah.
And it stayed in print until about 2007.
Yeah, okay. 2005 to 2007. I don't remember the exact year, but around in there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they dropped it,
yeah, which happens all the time.
Yeah.
It used to happen more routinely. Nowadays, it's easier for a publisher to keep a book in print because they don't have to warehouse it. They mm-hmm. can just print it on demand as they need it. So we were a little surprised they let it go, but we were fine with that because it meant that we could then bring out an updated edition, which we wanted to do for a long time. There were chapters that in the first edition that talked about events of that were in the future that had already gone past, you know, mm-hmm. like the 2000 year 2000 appearance of Halley's Comet.
Yeah.
So yeah, we decided we'll do an updated edition and sell it to another publisher. Well, it was about 2007 because it's when the publishing industry went into decline, and suddenly nobody was buying any books. So last year, our agent in New York decided to start his own imprint, as many agents are doing now, to bring out his clients' backlist of older books in new editions mm-hmm. and make them available in print edition and as ebooks. So we jumped on board and we did the book. We brought it out, updated it, and cleaned it up in some ways that we had always wanted to, and presented it to him. And it's now back out in the world as a new edition.
And Glenn, you had part of the responsibility for making this happen.
I got to design it again. We didn't use the original film or anything. Mm-hmm. None of that existed. And there was a lot of, you know, little tweaks that we did, and Jerry did a lot of editing and, you know, updating. So it was a learning curve, but it was really fun to do that and supply it.
So we have the new edition. It's a new, fresh edition. It's an updated edition, something you probably weren't expecting to do, but it's turned out beautifully, hasn't it?
Yeah, we're really happy with it. It's been a terrific experience. You know, you never really want to spend a whole lot of time looking back at mm-hmm. your work. You know, you do the best you can and you move on to the next project. But I've come to think of, you know, these books as old friends, and almost like it's almost like we're tending the orchard, you know, taking care of our old trees and keeping
them healthy. Well, this is a timeless book, and to have a chance to do those small changes just makes it alive for another generation, or two or three.
As artists, you always want to, you know, you're always curious when you're younger about what's going to last, what you make, and we're, you know, we're both in our 60s now, and it's lasted, so it's nice that it's having a second act, and it's kind of stood up to the test of time.
So if listeners are interested in your individual work, you both have very good websites.
GlennWolf.com.
And
JerryDennis.net.
.net, yes. He's one of the new guys. And the book is available locally everywhere, I think.
Yeah.
So Glenn Wolf, Jerry Dennis, thank you for being here. The book again is It's Raining Frogs and Fishes. My congratulations.
Thanks for having us.